Okay, welcome back to another episode of the Corporate Real Estate Insider Podcast. Here is episode 41. Today we're covering a wide variety of topics, everything from some major office landlords having recently reported earnings to a few specific markets that are having a really challenging time, talking about manufacturing and a couple other things. Definitely going to be a full and interesting episode. To start us off, Brian, I know that you wanted to talk about Boston properties. No surprise, everything Brian related is Boston focused. So let's hear about the latest earnings report.
Thanks, Tucker. Well, just to, for our audience, Boston Properties is headquartered in Boston. They have 54 million square feet of office product nationally. I think they're number one or number two largest office landlord in the country. So somewhat of a bellwether for the overall market. But in reading through their earnings release and the conversation that they had with the analysts, there was an interesting segment on premier office space. So Boston Properties likes to distinguish themselves as owning the best real estate in the markets that they operate in. They certainly do in Boston with their large portfolio in the Back Bay. So premier workspace is defined as the highest quality 6.5% of buildings, representing 13.1% of total space in our five CBD markets, continually to materially outperform the broader market. Direct vacancy for these premier workspaces is 13% versus 18.5% for the broader market. Likewise, this is interesting, net absorption for premier workspace was a positive 6.9 million square feet over the last 3 years versus a negative 22.8 million square feet for the broader market. Huge difference. Asking rents for premier workspaces are 51% higher than the broader market. This outperformance is evident in Boston Properties portfolio, where just under 90% of their NOI comes from assets located in CBDs that are predominantly premier workspaces. The CBD's assets are 90% occupied and 92.2% leased. So it's an interesting thing, right? We've been talking about this flight to quality over many different podcasts and how companies are really evaluating the quality of their workspace in relation to the broader market, in relation to their competitors, but also just as a way to attract their people back to the office. It is, as these stats point in this earnings release, that it is clear that the premium office space is where companies want to be and are doubling down, as they say, to the tune of what, 30 million square feet of swing between the broader market and the premier space in terms of absorption over the last 3 years, which I thought was really interesting.
I'm suspicious about some of this reporting. Can you go back through it? Like, what were the data points? What are the positive? For example, they're throwing out there that the asking lease rates are 51% higher than non-premier. So first of all, we've had this conversation. Asking lease rates are irrelevant and have remained largely unchanged. So, but here they're throwing out a good sounding number. So I'm discarding that one. What were the other positive data points?
Well, it's 5% less vacant, right? 13 versus 18. And 6.9 million square feet of positive absorption versus 22.8 million square feet of negative absorption. 30 million square foot swing between the two asset classes.
And that's from year to year?
That's three. It's a three-year total. It's a running three-year total. But I think, John, your point on asking rents are relevant. I don't agree with you there. In this sense, they are relevant because you got to start from somewhere, right? And when you look at them in the context of the overall asking rents across the segments of the market, they are relevant in my mind based upon where the deals end up, but they're not irrelevant as you look at a cross section of the marketplace to see how buildings stack up with each other, right? I totally agree with you. In the deal, who cares what the landlord is asking? You got to negotiate based upon the fundamentals in the marketplace that and what they're competing against for options. But as if you look at it from a cross section, these buildings are going to ask more and they're going to achieve more. And that's in itself indicative of the fact that they are 5% less vacant. They're achieving a volume of transactions at a pace that outpaces the rest of the market. And that's why landlords are, and you see in Boston, the newest buildings are leased. We just hit the high watermark on a comp for a biotech company in the Seaport for a building that was delivered about 5 years ago. They just leased two floors, and it's the first lease in the Seaport of Boston that's hit triple digits for office. So it was a 70, low 70s net lease with roughly $30 in tax and operating. So on a gross basis, it's over $100 a foot. First time ever that I know of, the Seaport has hit that level for an office lease. And we're talking about it being signed within the last 30 days.
So do you have other details on that? I had a conversation this weekend with a lab landlord in the Bay Area, quoting on brand new, shiniest, newest lab building to deliver to the market, where they can strike at monthly rates, low sevens, triple net, which sounds a little bit like what you're describing there. But they can provide $350 a foot in TI on a 7-year deal. Like, that lease rate isn't much more than the amortized cost of that TI.
Yeah. So I'm sorry. This was an office. This was about a company signing a lease for pure office. So that's an office deal. The biotech leases are totally separate. Those have hit triple digits many times over. But this is a biotech user signing a lease for office. I think they got about $150 or $175 a foot in tenant improvements.
Well, and it speaks to my next question for you was like, okay, so they've went from 22.8 million of negative net absorption to 6.9 million square feet of positive absorption. That's fantastic. What I'd like to know is how they got there, and did they capitulate? Are they, you know, offering concessions that are reflective of the current market in a way that they weren't 2 years ago or 3 years ago? How they got there, I think, is really important.
Yeah, it's interesting. So they're at average concessions per, I saw this somewhere else, per square foot per year is $11 a foot. If I was to tell you the broader market here today is 13 to 15, it can get up to, right? So it's actually less. And from the data that I have. But if you think about the best buildings in your market, each of us, right? Those buildings are leased. Those buildings have a much higher occupancy. They have higher, stronger tenant credit, and they have momentum in an overall market that's really challenged. Think of Hudson Yards in New York City. Think of the Seaport or Back Bay in Boston. Think, Owen, in your market. I don't know where you talk about, but you tell me. Are those buildings outperforming the broader market?
Yeah, it's there are some of the nicest buildings are outperforming the market, but it's interesting because if I told you what the best buildings were in the Seattle Bellevue area, it's not a secret, but for many of our listeners that aren't in Seattle Bellevue, they won't know what they are. But if I gave you the list, in terms of quality, yes, some of them are definitely outperforming the broader market, but some of them aren't performing at all, literally not at all. And it's not because of the quality, it's because of the landlord's ability to transact. And so I think what you have to have in order to outperform the market is not only a quality building that is above the rest, but also a landlord who has the capital to fund concessions and get creative on transacting, because it's clearly evident in this market that there are buildings that fall into that, you know, that top 6%, top 5% in terms of quality. But if you look at their transaction history, they've almost done absolutely zero leasing in the past 24 months when their competitors have done otherwise and done very well. So I think you have to look at both. And I think you also have to look at location, because there are instances where, submarkets outperform others. So there might be a third factor. It's not only you have to be in the top 5%, you have to have a landlord that can transact, and you have to be in a great location.
By the way, why 6.5%? Like, have they always measured to show the top 6.5%? Or did they maybe run it a few ways and see which one developed and delivered the best story?
It's a good question. I would say it's probably more the latter than the former, right? They want to take a subset that includes the best story because most of their product is in that subset. But I would tell you, in a city like Boston, and if you look at some of the buildings even down in New York, the location, as long as your you're within the striking distance of these companies, right? You can't be outside of their comfort zone. But the knock on Hudson Yards in New York was location for a long time, and that performed beautifully and hit the high water mark in the city when other locations, maybe one or two buildings, premier buildings as well, hit really high rents. But that it performed at a level that blew away expectations. In Boston, there's two buildings in the financial district, and I would argue that they're not great locations, but they've signed forward leases for tenants. The one that's under construction for Hines over Sell Station just signed two tenants, three floors to tenants that are new to, well, one of them is new to the market for two floors coming from the suburbs. In a location that's less desirable than, you know, some of these other A buildings that would be, that would be a better location for their people, but they wanted to be in the newest building. And same with the Millennium Tower that's, right in the dead center of the financial district is signed Deloitte to the building and a number of other professional service firms that are in a low rise of the building. The high rise of this particular building is residential. So, here it's certainly the case that the newest buildings, the premier office, is significantly outperforming the broader market.
So going back to this comment around Hudson Yards, being in a suboptimal location and having really high performance, I think it's worth noting just the like scale and size of Hudson Yards. I mean, it's basically a city with how big it is. It just happens to be a submarket in the middle of the largest office market in the country. And in pretty much any other market, you can't just go and say, hey, I'm going to go put up a, you know, 50-story high-rise building in a bad location, and this is going to perform well. Like, that won't work in probably like 99% of geographies, but it does work in New York when you have massive scale and you essentially build a city. It's like, you know, what some of these crazy projects in Saudi Arabia are, right? Like The Line and different things like that, where they're going to spend like hundreds of billions of dollars building a brand new city that looks really cool. We'll see if it ever gets built. But if you go in and you build enough scale and you make it a place and fill everything in with, you know, apartments, lifestyle centers, retail, offices, and all that, then you have the ability to transform an entire area that is not cool, that maybe doesn't have great access, into somewhere that is great because people now live there. And that's the story of Hudson Yards and why so many people were skeptical around how it would perform. Is the question was, will there really be critical mass? And now that there is, it's a you know, cool spot to be, as evidenced by all of the companies that have leased space there. I think there also was this element of really large companies needing hundreds of thousands of square feet of space in Class A plus buildings. And you look at just the amount of Class A plus inventory in New York that was delivering around that time. And it's not like there were tons of options if you were 300,000 or 400,000 square feet. So a lot of them ended up making decisions off of that. So anyways, just wanted to make that distinction. John, before we go back to you, I agree with you on this, like 6.5% of premium office space seems like a sliced and diced type of number. I agree. I think Boston Properties portfolio is primarily comprised of premium office space, and they have been doing really well. I also think that they are one of the best performing landlords in terms of being deal makers and getting stuff done, being responsive, being a great landlord. And I think that's obviously part of why their performance has been so high relative to others. I also wanted to point out, beyond the 6.5% figure, is that this like definition of premium office space and like what comprises the top 6.5%, like what are we going off of here? Is it a subjective, like, oh, I like that building's nicer than the other ones, I like that building more? Is it what rents are being achieved? Is it vacancy? Like, there, it's so subjective to say, like, what is a top building? Even if you just say, hey, let's only look at the top 6.5%, the percentage is kind of an interesting selected percentage. But in addition to that, how you determine what's included in that 6.5% is, I think, pretty tough to grasp.
So I think this becomes really important because it points, for me, it points to the inefficiency in the commercial real estate market generally. Like, it is so opaque. There's such a lack of transparent transactional information And it's something that can be exploited by office building owners, right? It's the reason they've largely left asking rents unchanged. And what you're pointing to maybe makes me think that some are going to get away with this, like, because businesses need to proceed. Businesses need to transact. And then maybe they don't have the appetite to go in and discover the new market pricing level, and they get a good deal and that's good enough. So here's my question to the group. I'd be curious to hear from you, because this isn't the only example of a media piece I've seen that points to a bottom, a trough, a turning up, and suggests that maybe we've hit a bottom, maybe we're getting through this thing, and maybe from here it's going to be up and to the right again. Do you think that's what's happening in the office market? I'll go first. I don't think so broadly. I think there's going to be examples of strength. We've talked about that consistently on this pod. The flight to quality is real. We've also talked about the, you know, a receding tide is going to lower all boats. This downward pressure on the yield spread for the premium stuff. But like, are you suggesting, Brian, that this is cause for optimism for office building owners generally? And let's weigh in as a group.
So my take on it is a little different than that. I would tell you that no, the answer to your question specifically is no. What I think is exciting and interesting is that you used to be able, you'd buy a Class A building that has the amenities of a Class A building, right? Parking, elevators with security and a high quality lobby, and has the look and feel of a Class A building. You used to be able to do some minor kind of, you know, paint and minor capital work, and you would be able to achieve some of the highest rents in that particular market. It was a game you could play that allowed you to classify your building at the same rental rates generally as some of the nicest buildings in the marketplace. And you would be shocked at some of these buildings, that the rents they were achieving in comparison to some other higher quality buildings that are newer with better amenities and, you know, a higher price point in terms of the base building and construction costs to deliver it. And if it was traded, the price that they paid when the building traded. But everything kind of just got lopped into this Class A or Class A, and then it was kind of Class A minus. I think right now the market is bifurcating massively, and tenants, our clients, are really understanding what drives performance of a building, what makes their employees happy within the environment of a building, and where they want to be. And they're not allowing landlords to, you know, it's like kind of that top 5-6.5%, and then everybody else. And everybody else is going to go through serious pain. Some of the buildings are going to go away. Those landlords are going to be turning buildings back to lenders. And then you have these performing buildings and these high performance owners and high performance buildings, really good air quality, really good natural light. They just are places that people want to go. And that's going to be the new standard. And I think everybody is going to be chasing that. And the marketplace is not going to allow kind of a second-rate building to be in that category anymore, like they did for the last 10 years or longer, in my mind.
So last week, I had a client, I put in a 20,000 square foot suburban office building, got him a great deal 15 years ago, plus or minus. And then the management team changed. The CEO left, CFO left, the board members that I knew left. And I was all over them. I'm reaching out. I'm like, that lease is coming up. We need to do something. Let's get in front of it. Couldn't break through. I figured somebody came in and knew somebody and I'm out. Shame on me. Then I got a call. They want to meet. They want to talk about that space. And so I went in last week and had a conversation with them. They want to know how to get out of the 5-year lease they just signed. I'm like, what happened? There are 50 people in 20,000 feet. I'm like, well, you don't need 20,000 feet. No, by the way, what's your utilization? Oh, it's like 40%. I'm like, well, why'd you commit to 20,000 feet? They said, well, we went to the landlord and asked them to reduce the space. And he said, no. Oh, I'm like, did you have a broker? Who'd you work with? I look him up. I've never heard his name, never heard the company. Oh, it's a retail broker. He does fast food, drive-through locations. And they're like, yeah, but we got an allowance, you know, $5 a foot that mostly covered the cost of new carpet and paint. We only put new carpet in the hallways. We couldn't pay to put it in the offices as well. And they got 2 months free. and they're asking me to get them out of the lease, and I'm bearing the bad news, like, that was not a good deal, and you're lucky if you save 50 cents on the dollar. I doubt we're going to get that. And this idea that that landlord, good on him, but man, the opaque, the lack of transparency, the lack of efficiency in the market clearing prices in commercial real estate, I think there's a bit of that playing out in every market.
That's a good story. I'm going to go back, though, to what Brian said. He made a strong statement that the market was not going to bear anything but, buildings with great air quality, natural light, et cetera. I don't disagree. I mean, there's always going to be a preference for better quality buildings. But we just talked about that top tier being 6.5% of the overall market. There's more tenants than 6 to 6.5% of the overall market. So this might be some good news for people who own buildings that are maybe a step below the high quality stuff, is that I do believe there's going to be a space and an opportunity and a market for those B plus A minus buildings. But if you're going to operate in that sphere, you have to do what you can to make your building as close to those premium buildings as possible, and provide a very significant capital contribution, because the only reason a tenant's going to opt to lease space in an inferior building, inferior to that, premium set that we've been talking about on this pod today, is if they have a substantial allowance to build out incredible space within, because they're certainly not going to be arriving to work in the building that their neighbor might be in, which is better. Their employees won't be able to benefit from all the amazing things that maybe that premium building offers. But if someone can build it out within their premises, it might be reason for them to opt for second class tier building in exchange for the savings they'll realize through a lower rent. And that lower rent's going to have to be substantially lower than that premium set. But there'll always be that. There's certainly that flight to quality going on, but I do believe there are tenants that, despite how much they want their people back, if they do, they're going to opt for, that second tier commodity type building, so long as the landlord offers the compelling terms to entice them to do so and not go super high quality, super high cost.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all. You're 100% right. My point was that the marketplace for Class A buildings is continuing to separate, where you've got the top 6.5% that are going to continue to perform. And especially in core markets, it's amazing how well some of the leases we're seeing and the deals that are coming out, like COVID never happened, work from home never happened, right? And everything else is continuing. John's question was, have we found the bottom? My answer was, for 94.5% of the marketplace, we are nowhere near the bottom. It is going to continue to go down. Options are going to continue to come back to market, and clients are going to continue to find ways to save money over existing leases. But the top of the market is amazingly performing well. And there's a reason. It really is. Like, companies that can pay for it will pay for it. Like, if you look at the list of tenants, I know we talked about Hudson Yards, but you think about, and by the way, I was down in New York a couple months ago, and I think I said this, I have a friend who's in Manhattan, who's an executive in a real estate company. And he said, our clients don't want to be in Hudson Yards. They don't want to take the train over. They don't want to be kind of pigeonholed in the corner. They want to be in it. They want to be in the middle of it. They want to be able to come into one of the main transportation stops, right? Grand Central, Penn Station, and they want to be able to hopefully walk from there. They don't want to have to get on the 7 and go all the way over. And if you're coming in from certain spots, Hudson Yards is a disaster. But your point was, think about some of the tenants. Warner Brothers Discovery is one of the major tenants, I think, in 30 Hudson Yards. You've got KKR in the building. You've got BlackRock over there. You've got Meta, right? You just have massive companies with huge, it's just huge pools of resources, huge pools of people, and top of the market credit. And those types of companies are making these choices. Everybody else that isn't in those categories are really good companies, like really quality companies that maybe just don't have the same size operation or aren't printing cash like Meta or Google, that are making other choices. And those options could be really, really nice options, but the market is flush with opportunity. And I think the market is going to continue to deteriorate for those types of users.
I wanted to add on to Brian's point around the market separation that's occurring. Obviously, we were talking about how premium office space is already commanding a 51% premium in terms of asking rents compared to non-premium office space. And the reality is that the actual separation is quite a bit larger than that. The non-premium product has way more pricing flexibility embedded in the asking rents than premium properties generally do. So there's obviously a very high level of variance depending on which premium asset it is and what the specific situation is on any given space. But there are certain premium buildings in the Los Angeles market, for example, where there's pretty minimal movement that's available on the asking rate. There might be movement that's available on the concessions, but you know, if a building's sitting at 99% occupancy and your lease is coming up for renewal, and there's probably not going to be much movement on the rental rate, particularly if it's a, you know, owner that's heavily focused on maintaining high face rates for their rents. But for basically any other type of landlord, there's significantly more. And sometimes in certain instances on short-term deals, we're now starting to see some landlords say, hey, you know what? I don't care at all about the implied valuation of this lease. I know that in order for me to not be underwater on my building, I need to achieve X, but I'm willing to transact on a 2-year lease for 50% of X just to get the cash flow. Because I know if I don't do that, I'm going to lose this company and I'm not going to backfill that space for at least 2 or 3 years. And I want the cash flow, we haven't seen that much of that. And that's sort of the new reality of today, but only for non-premium space. And as that happens, it's only going to incentivize companies to do shorter term deals if they're in a position to do so, right? If it's a renewal where there's no capital and a landlord's willing to do that, why relocate to a sublease if you can get a 50% reduction in what the market is in your current space without having to incur move costs? And we're finally starting to see landlords do that.
I think it's a great point, Tucker. It reminded me of a story. I have a client that isn't ready to start. They're going to start within the next month. But the landlord, these landlords are, I don't know what the word is, but you tell me. So he sends the landlord. I've worked with this company. They send a unsolicited rent, you know, rental proposal, they called it. They didn't call it an LOI or anything. It's like a rent proposal for a renewal at $45 a foot with $50 in work for a 5-year lease. But in the proposal, it explicitly says that if you work with a broker, this offer is null and void. So they're trying to go around, like, think about that. They're trying to go around brokers. So he called me and I was like, well, what do you think they did that for? He's like, well, I think I'm going to get a better deal if I just sign this. I said, well, just so you know, like, the market's probably $38 a foot. It's probably $50 to $75 a foot in capital for that same lease. And it's 6 to 12 months, probably 8 to 12 months of free rent on that deal. Right. And I think they had 4 months or 5 months of free rent. So the landlords are getting desperate. And I said, we can go back to them and just sign a 2-year lease, 3-year lease at $35 a foot as is probably. And he's looking at me like, well, with free rent, you know, you get down to like a $30 effective. And he's like, that's a $10 spread over what they proposed. And they told me this is the best deal they can do and I shouldn't hire a broker. I'm like, yeah, they're telling that because they don't want you to hire a broker because you're going to overpay if they can get you to go directly. It's effectively what, John, your example, that's what they did. I mean, that residential broker or retail broker didn't know the market and didn't do the homework to learn the market. And the landlord effectively did a direct deal at their asking rent without any leverage or representation for the tenant. And, you know, it's funny because you're exactly right, Tucker. These landlords will go where they don't want to go to keep tenants in the building because it's years before they could backfill the space. Years. It could be 5 years for some of these, Class B or A minus buildings that have less quality space that, you know, where tenants, and once you leave, you're never coming back. So there's a lot of opportunity, but they have to post the rents at $45 a foot with, you know, $30 or $40 in work, but it is nowhere near where the market will end up, at the end of the day.
Yeah, generally, the more the landlord pushes for you to not have a broker involved, the more reason there is to have a broker involved. When landlords are putting forward fair deals, they generally are like, I would prefer to have a broker involved so that they can tell this company that has no context on the market, since this isn't what they do, that this is actually a fair deal. This is going to make my life easier if there's someone that understands the market that's involved. I had a recent transaction where company, like friend of a friend, and it's a sizable company. It was over 100,000 foot industrial transaction, but another same type of deal, retail broker got involved, has no way to even understand which way's up, which way's down, get a proposal. Someone on the executive team says, hey, this just doesn't seem like a good proposal. We need to evaluate this. And within 3 weeks of us being hired, we'd reduced the rental rate that was proposed by the landlord by 40%. And you're just sitting there being like, this is like just so negligent of these people to try and do these deals with no context, no other competing landlord, no other building, nothing. And just like show up and say, hey, send me a proposal, and not have the client understand that they have no idea what they're doing. Yeah, it's a wild world out there sometimes.
Well, and think about it, this story is as old as time. There's nothing new here. I think I'm going to write an article. I'm going to title it Beware the Renewal, because the market clearing price is found in the relocation. When you can find an owner who's just bought the property from foreclosure and at 50 cents on the dollar. So they've got the reduced basis. They can bring in fresh capital. They can, you know, meet the market where it is today. So the market clearing price is found via a relocation. And unless a company is willing to go there, they're not going to find it. And this idea of a renewal at above market, whatever market means, but an unsuspecting renewal from an existing tenant who doesn't want to spend the time and energy to go discover that market clearing price, that's the saving grace. That's the path forward. That's what they're banking on. And to some extent, successfully executing. You know, I wish I'd gotten my call through to that executive team, you know, a year ago before they signed that 5-year renewal. I believe they would have done much, much better. So this idea that the market clearing price is found in the relocation, and all too many companies don't have the time or the energy or the inclination to go discover it. And so landlords may get away with that strategy. We'll see. Okay. So the pivot to DC is interesting because here's a very large tenant, the GSA, the federal government leasing space in and around DC. But they're not generally known for, you know, leasing class A office space in the best locations. They're an interesting data point. They tend to move a little bit slower. So this from July 26th, an article titled GSA doubles down on shedding federal office space, that the General Services Administration doubling down on efforts to sell or dispose of office space that agencies no longer need. The quotes are from Elliot Dooms, commissioner of GSA's Public Buildings Service. Over the last 4 years, GSA has reduced its footprint by almost 8 million square feet. And over half of its 8,000 leases are coming up for renewal in the next 5 years. I would expect that most agencies will not be renewing at the same footprint that they have now, and that our stakeholders on Capitol Hill are going to demand reductions. For context, GSA owns 36.7 million square feet of building space in the National Capital Region, about 2 million square feet sitting vacant today. And the state stuff that's occupied is largely underutilized. Here's a quote on that. The GAO, Government Accountability Office, found last summer that all agency headquarters buildings in the Washington, D.C. area had excess space. They all had excess space, including 17 that had an average utilization of just 25%. So there's some clearing work to be done through the GSA. And then one more quick article. I go back a couple of weeks. This is from July 9th. This is how they solved the problem. GSA says more funds needed to offload unneeded federal office space. We're going to need to spend money in order to save money, says Elliot Dooms, same person again. And so they went and asked Congress for $425 million. They call it an optimization fund. for next year's budget, and funding would help the agencies move out of underutilized office space. And one last two sentences quote, although it's agency by agency, I'll tell you the trend is agencies are giving up space. They understand. We're bringing our workspace experts to work with these agencies to say, how often are people there? What kind of work do you do? Maybe you don't need all that space. Let's give some of that space back, says Dooms. Here's what the federal government's doing.
So I saw a stat researching this that the Government Accountability Office looked at 24 federal agencies, and they found that 17 of those 24 federal agencies were using 25% or less of their headquarters buildings. Right. So, I think they, regardless of what they're giving up, there's some work to still be done if the government actually wanted to right size the portfolio. Now, if you talk, if you listen to the mayor, I forget her name off the top of my head, but she is standing on the top of every building she can, screaming to get the government back because the city needs it. Like every city needs it, but they are a one trick pony in DC, obviously. And when the government is, you know, using this, the occupancy rates are so low, the city is really suffering for it. Unfortunately, cause it's a wonderful city and I love DC, but, there's a lot of factors that are impacting, and the GSA, like any, any government agency, but really like any, company with these large of operations is really probably struggling to figure out how to either get their people back, but also right size the portfolio and make all these pieces work together. It's a daunting task, for them coming out of, you know, just massive, change in strategy for utilization of space for the government.
And it's a lesson for those, property owners that invest in a market that's so heavily weighted on one particular tenant. The federal government, the GSA, as John was talking about, they occupy 90 million square feet of space, in the DC metro area. Now, the DC metro area is 370 million square feet. So, you know, it's just a little bit shy of a third of all the product, you know, and of that product, 131 million's in what you would consider DC proper. And there's obviously Northern Virginia and suburban Maryland. Northern Virginia has substantially more than Maryland. But what's going on in DC is consistent across the whole country, guys. I mean, there's foreclosures are on the rise, property values are dropping precipitously, vacancy rates are going through the roof. DC, for what it's worth, has the highest vacancy rate right now in the history of Washington, DC. I was looking at the probability of leasing space. So we track, as do most companies, you know, you look at how long space sits on the market. Okay. And I was looking at probability thresholds of say 50%. Okay. There's a 50% chance if you have space that comes back today in your building in DC that it will lease in 9 months, 60% chance it will lease in a year. Beyond that, it could take even longer. That's also at record highs. And you look at what's happening this November, it really doesn't matter whether we have a Democrat elected as our next president or a Republican, because the current administration's had a heck of a time trying to get people to come back to the office and has even, to some extent, promoted remote work. And if we have a Republican in office, you know, our nominee has even suggested getting away of the education department, which is like 2,500 employees. And while he may, you know, ask people to come back to the office, there could be a reduction in overall need for occupancy because of cuts. So it's a real problem there. And Brian, like you mentioned, I mean, the mayor is kind of shouting from every building rooftop trying to haul people back, but it's caused a real big problem in DC, especially with those that are dependent upon that economic activity. Think bars, restaurants, small businesses. You know, when these federal workers are not coming to the office, or maybe once a week at best, how can you survive if you're a retailer or you're someone that depends on that occupancy downtown? And so this remote work has crushed DC. And John, you mentioned all the leases that are expiring. There's over 600,000 square feet that has already been kind of slated to be vacated by 2027, where the GSA has already said, we're not going to renew this lease. So it's pretty crazy out there. So we'll see kind of what happens, but the thing that people aren't really talking about, but is kind of common sense, is that beyond all the struggles, right, in terms of having a vibrant downtown and getting people back to work, with the drop of property values, it's causing DC to have a $500 million gap in their budget, mostly related to the real estate tax collection. So when the assessor's office has to reassess property values and they haul in way less property tax collections, think what that does to their budget. And this is something that's happening across the country right now. And so I'm not trying to paint a doomsday scenario, but this return to work has far greater repercussions than the buildings themselves. It really affects these municipal, you know, towns, cities, you name it. It's pretty far and wide. So DC is, yes, they're in a world of hurt, but they're not alone. Obviously, those listening on this pod know what's going on in West Coast cities like Seattle and San Francisco, and there's others to talk about as well.
Okay, shifting gears away from the sad state of the DC office market as well as other office markets, I wanted to talk a little bit about a bright spot that is occurring that I feel like a lot of people don't understand, or at least aren't thinking about. So if you look at the 12-month total construction investment in manufacturing, just in the U.S., it is up 19% from last year, and it's up 100% from 2 years ago, and it's up about 220% from the same period in 2019. The total amount of 12-month construction spend on manufacturing plants is up to $235 billion in the U.S. And it's really interesting. I read this article over the weekend talking about all, you know, a bunch of different segments of the economy. And now I'm doing a lot more research on what's comprised of that $235 billion of spend. People have different ways of categorizing factories, right? Like, is it just semiconductor plants? Is it aerospace for, you know, the next, you know, SpaceX rocket? Is it automotive manufacturing? How much of it is, you know, Tesla? How much of it is new factories for defense-based spending based on everything that's going on in the world right now, and a lot of focus on supply chain resiliency and manufacturing resiliency with defense products in particular? So anyways, hopefully for next episode, I'm going to have a breakdown on what is comprising that 220% increase in manufacturing factory spend since 2019. But that's a big increase, and it already was, a high number in 2019. So, interesting stuff.
Yeah, we're certainly seeing it here in New England in a market that historically hasn't seen a lot of manufacturing growth, because most of it was, you know, this market is R&D, and it's not priced. We have some of the highest prices for commodities in the country. We have some of the highest priced labor markets in the country. And we have some of the highest priced real estate markets in the country. But we are seeing, and it's all advanced manufacturing right here. There has to be a reason to be here other than a pure cost play, obviously. But it's, even in those situations, you're seeing a oversized amount of projects get approved and funded and built, which has been pretty exciting, having worked on a number of them myself, and also, seeing the marketplace mature for those types of users. It's been great. We have the clean tech or the tough tech markets here historically have been, that the incubator, the R&D, and then manufacturing gets done somewhere else. And you need to find the right site with the right partners. You need to use incentives. You need to bring a team together to help negotiate this that isn't a pure real estate play. You're arbitraging a lot of incentives to help reduce costs. But there's a number of companies that are doing their first-gen plants in the market, right? There's value in having it next to your headquarters, next to your R&D, rather than putting it in a lower-cost market down south or in the Midwest or the Southwest, Jason, lower labor or lower power costs. And it's been pretty exciting seeing that kind of build out here, and companies make sense of it for a number of reasons. So yeah, it's a great conversation.
Interesting to me. And by the way, I think it's only getting going. Like, I think it's going to continue to build and grow and be recognized as really strong for America. It's interesting to me that it's, love him or hate him, you know, Biden and the Biden administration don't get the credit for a lot of these things, you know, whether it's the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, Inflation Reduction Act, CHIPS and Science Act. You know, those programs are largely behind the U.S. manufacturing investment that we're seeing. You can tell me I'm wrong and tell me otherwise, but it's interesting that everyone's sort of mum on the fact that, love them or hate them, that those have been good policies and good programs, and we're just starting to see the dividends from them. I think we'll see more in the future.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what the report tells you, Tucker, what the data suggests, because you know, here in the Northwest, we don't have any big semiconductor plants, but we have an incredibly skilled workforce, some of which, you know, attracts some of the most, you know, well-known, brightest companies in the world to occupy space here. And then we also have a lot of natural resources, as people know, up here in the Northwest. I'm curious how much of that is driving some of this work and aerospace. So, yeah, this will be fascinating. This could be an entire pod.
Okay, you guys ready to close on a lighter note? Almost totally unrelated to real estate, except somehow, you know, how to lie with numbers, probability, and statistics. Maybe there's a common theme there. I was sitting yesterday afternoon thinking about the pod and what might be interesting to cover, and I was reading about the Olympics. Here we are, it's, you know, wrapping the final week of the Summer Olympics in Paris. And the headlines, you know, feeling proud as an American to see the United States at the top, tied with China as number one for gold medals. Some separate question of whether what's more important, gold medals or total medals. We'll just focus on gold. And so it lists out the top 10, whatever news you're reading probably has the same list and you guys keep track of it. Those numbers have changed now since events went on last evening. But then it occurred to me, like, of course, US and China are at the top of the list. Like, what if we accounted for population? Or what if we accounted for GDP? What's another measure of, like, the health and wellness of a nation that the athletes can afford to spend all this time training? And so we'll just do population. And so I included population data. The United States has 333 million, China 1.412 billion, and then put that alongside the top 10, 1 through 10, and then said, well, how many gold medals on a GDP basis, like, say, per 100 million people? And isn't that an interesting data point? Okay, so the United States and China are no longer number one and number two. They're now number nine and number 10. I mentioned that we each have 19 gold medals, and it tracks down France with 12 in third place, Great Britain with 10 in fourth, and the bottom three, Italy with 7, Canada with 5, and Netherlands with 5. So when we switch it, we do it, how many gold medals per 100 million people? Netherlands goes from last place to second place. Australia takes the top spot. They were number 5 on the list on a raw ranking. And again, US and China become 9 and 10. But look at the numbers, you know, where it was 19 each for the US and China in just raw gold medals, and the Netherlands had 5. Now at the top of the list, Australia has 46 gold medals per 100 million people. The Netherlands has 34 gold medals per 100 million people. The United States, 6 per 100 million people. China, 1 per 100 million people. Pretty interesting that we take so much pride in these raw numbers when, in fact, some of these small nations are just crushing it. They've got some strong athletes. Thought that would be a fun way to dice and slice the Olympic results.
We got to get John engaged with some of these landlords trying to make their portfolios and performance look better. This guy will cut your numbers any which way, make it look good. Unfortunately, also making the U.S. look bad, but maybe next time slice them in our favor, John. And agreed, not real estate related at all, but John talks about whatever John wants to talk about.
I'm going to work on this for the next step, because as it turns out, if we just look at the top 6.5% of gold medal performances, the U.S. is the top.
Okay, great.
I mean, I wanted, John went to the Olympics. I wanted to comment on his comment that the investments by the U.S. federal government as being a primary driver of manufacturing coming back to the U.S. You know, my personal opinion, John, just to kind of leave it here, is that if you look globally, global unrest and uncertainty and the risk profile of different theaters, to me, would be a much bigger reason that companies start to make investments in safe geopolitical environments and cost shorty situations where they can predict what their costs are going to be. The incentives help them get there. But if you pick your head up outside the U.S., this world is somewhat falling apart around us at times. And the United States and a few other countries are, just the constant. And if I was building a manufacturing plant, you'd have to take that. And it is working with clients. Those are major issues on why they put plants where they put them. I can go back 20, 25 years and we were building in China as fast as we could build for certain clients, you know, millions of square feet. And some of that and a lot of it has moved to other markets because they need to diversify risk over the last 20 years, right? The arbitrage in cost isn't as great. You chase low cost markets like Vietnam, like at the time, South Korea was in the mix. But really Vietnam right now. And those political uncertainty, cost uncertainty, and supply chain uncertainty are reasons, if you think about manufacturing from a drug perspective, like bringing all that back to the U.S., it's not a policy decision. That's just an economic and a geopolitical decision.
So, Brian, on this point, we can agree, whether it's manufacturing or Olympic performance, go USA.
Exactly.
Yeah, Brian, I'm with you. I think the vast majority of increase in factory spend domestically is driven by geopolitical challenges and concerns, risk mitigation, and far less due to the Infrastructure Act and the CHIPS Act and things like that. I mean, Brian, we've been in meetings with these companies where they say, hey, look, incentives are great, but it doesn't move the needle. It's still so, so much less expensive to do this stuff in China than it is in the US that, yeah, it helps. It helps make the gap smaller, but the gap's still so big that the reason to be located for this specific requirement or whatever in the US is risk mitigation. So anyways, agree, John, go USA from a manufacturing standpoint, from a metal standpoint, from a podcast standpoint, right? Okay, let's wrap there. That's episode 41. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening. And we'll be back in another 2 weeks with 42. Thanks.